Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. It's Tuesday, the 25th of August, 2009, which just happens to be my birthday, but we won't get into that. I'm Herwood Fenton. I'm your host tonight, going it alone. Josh is away for a month. I'll be here, though, regularly. I've been getting a few emails from listeners saying that they're addicted to the show, and that's great. But, you know, that means I've got to keep doing this, so the pressure is on, okay, because I don't want to let people down if they feel that strongly about it. So, yeah, look, tonight we've got a whole bunch of stuff that I'm going to run through. I've got a lot of stories here lined up. I want to nail quite a few of them in the first part. Then in the second half, I'm getting John Bursell on the show. And we are going to explore the mysteries of chemtrails. Now, if that word doesn't mean anything to you, that's okay, you're forgiven. It does mean something to a lot of people. And for those who are unfamiliar with the term, you know, you may have looked up on a sunny day with a beautiful blue sky and seen the occasional sort of white line moving across the sky at a very high altitude from a plane that can barely be seen. This is this phenomenon, which occurs sporadically in Australia, is known by some as chemtrails. What is a chemtrail? Well, there are two versions of that. There's, I guess, what you'd call the official version, and there's the kind of conspiratorial version. Now, we're going to explore the phenomenon with John in the second half. John is an aircraft engineer, and he obviously, you know, he works on large airplanes. He works on 757s, 767s. He knows a lot about the way they function, the type of fuel they use, how the engines work. So we're going to run through some of the conspiratorial ideas in regards to chemtrails, or contrails, as some people would prefer to call them. As for me, look, I go, you know, I follow the truth. I follow the truth as I perceive it, and I certainly don't claim that I'm always right. That would be ridiculous. You know, I try to be fair. This is a subject which is a problematic one. I've yet to be convinced that the chemtrail phenomena is anything other than condensation from a vapor trail. And John will be, you know, providing some, I guess, you know, expert input on that. And, you know, you can have a think about it and get back to us and let us know what you think. I mean, if you think we've missed out something here, if you think we're being biased in the way we cover it, well, of course, you know, any investigation is always biased. You know, you start off with some basic presumptions. And, you know, my basic presumption is, well, I'm not going to presume that there's something funny going on here. I'm going to presume open-minded, you know, approach. Well, it's a plane. There's a condensation trail that comes out of that plane, and I am aware of, you know, information that this can lead to the ice crystals can form clouds in certain atmospheric conditions, and it can be a very a knife edge type of scenario. It's almost like you need to apply chaos theory to understand the way in which, you know, in one situation, at one altitude, with a particular level of humidity, you'll suddenly get one of these persistent contrails. And in another moment, they won't be there, or at a slightly different altitude, it won't be there. Look, that's counterintuitive, you might say. Why wouldn't it always be there? Well, a lot of the things that happen in the real world of the physics of thermodynamics of this this reality that we live in, events can best be explained by chaos theory. And chaos theory deals with conditions of semi-randomness, where you have a lot of a sort of immeasurable amount of inputs of data or physical effects that affect a system, and that can push a system into different states. The classic example with chaos theory is the butterfly flapping its wings in South America can lead to a hurricane in the Atlantic. Well, that's an oversimplification, but the point here is that very small incidental changes can lead to massive changes further down the line in any complex system. And everything to do with weather and cloud formation is an incredibly complex system. So I don't wish to be condescending towards anyone in saying that I'm not personally convinced of the chemtrail phenomenon. I'm still looking and waiting for the amazing evidence, and I've had recently had some emails, and I looked at the emails, and well, to be honest with you, I didn't find them that amazing. So look, I hope you'll find that part of the show interesting. That's for part two. And look, as I said, please get back to me. Please get back to the show with all of your feedback and criticisms where necessary. So we'll just, on that note, we'll move into the first section of the show. Okay, well, look, tonight we've got, there are just so many stories, so many unfolding stories that we try to cover in Truth News Radio. It's always just, like a roulette game as to what we actually talk about, and we leave 90% of it untouched. I mean, if I were able to quit my day job and do this every day, we would probably get through a lot more. But, I can only squeeze in one show a week. And the people who come on the show are also extremely busy. Josh is currently away for a month in Germany, and good luck to him. We hope to actually get a report from him from Germany, because he's going to be there on September 11. And there are quite a number of truth groups which are formed in Germany, which will be putting on protests on the 11th of September 2009. So I'm hoping to get a report from Josh in Germany. Now look, I'm going to lead once again with the stories around the subject of swine flu and swine flu vaccination. Again, it's a subject that is absolutely going crazy in the blogosphere. A lot of people are very concerned about the swine flu vaccine. And I'll just read to you a few headlines, and you can, get a general picture of what's going on here. And a lot of these are quite oddly contradictory. For example, we have a story from late last week that says millions of Australians will be vaccinated against the deadly swine flu within weeks. And it says here that pregnant women and health workers will be the first to get the medicine. And it also says that the government has ordered 21 million doses, ladies and gentlemen. Yes, 21 million doses. That's one vaccine for every person in the country. You know, and it's funny because when you look at the Google flu trends, which we showed on the show a couple of weeks ago, what you see is a very mild flu season, getting milder and milder by the week. If you have a look at it now, you'll see it's actually in the low range, and it's never really been in the high range. It was maybe for one or two days, it was in the high range. It's never been in the intense range. It's very odd, isn't it? I mean, why are they so keen to vaccinate us all? I mean, they're assuming with that number there that we're all going to get the jab. Now, there's been cases of mandatory vaccination being announced in the United States, in New Jersey, and it was also announced in Maine. And you know, we have no mandatory rules here about swine flu vaccination. And in fact, no vaccination here is mandatory. And even though a lot of people are unaware of this, you know, you can get exemptions. Although, you know, there are exceptions, you know, and we've covered this last year when the family that was basically harassed by the Department of Community Services because they wouldn't have their child vaccinated for a Hep B, I think it was, Hep B vaccination. Well, that was an ambiguous situation, right? We still, I've been trying to track down Meryl Dorey to get her back on the show because we really want to follow up that story because it's very important for people to know what their rights are. I've been told by people who have kids in daycare that, contrary to what you're often told, is that you don't have to vaccinate. You can get an exemption. There are probably individual exceptions, or there may be exceptions where people have been told that they couldn't do it. But you know, sometimes you find what the person telling you is not exactly correct, and you can come back to them with your better knowledge of the law and say, "Well, actually, you're wrong. You know, you say I have to do this, but actually, there's an exemption here under our laws, under our constitution." A lot of what goes on in these matters is what we call color of law. It's where an official of some kind, it might be a policeman, it might even be just the person behind the desk at your childcare centre, just spout some regulation at you that supposedly impinges on you, supposedly, you know, is binding upon you, and you have to toe the line. So you think. This is a lot of the way things work in our society is this colour of law situation. Most people aren't informed. Most people don't read up. That either don't have the time or, you know, they're just not educated enough. So, you know, part of what we're trying to do at Truth News Radio is to help you get a more rounded education. And part of the in the process, of course, we get a better education ourselves. You know, as we inform you of things, we become more of a source because we interview people, we read the necessary articles we need to do a show. And, you know, although we're not experts in any one field, and we don't want to be, you know, but we can provide you a body of knowledge which has kind of been vetted, which has been through some screening. You know, we're not just going to tell you rubbish. So look, just getting back to the situation with the swine flu vaccines, it says that, you know, 21 million are going to be vaccinated, assuming that they ordered the vaccines for a purpose. But in the same week, there was a report from a group of doctors complaining that the vaccines were not safe. And this was an Australian group of highly qualified doctors. I just don't have the story right in front of me at the moment, but we'll put it up on the show notes, complaining that the vaccines weren't safe. You know, the method of delivery, the multi-dose vials. Now, there's also a recent poll which has been conducted in the UK, even more alarming. A new poll in the UK shows that close to 50% of GPs are going to refuse the vaccine. This is from the Daily Mail. I'll just read you the story. Half of GPs refuse swine flu vaccine over testing fears. Up to half of family doctors do not want to be vaccinated against swine flu. GPs will be first in line for the jabs when they become available, but many will decline, even though they will be offering the vaccine to their patients. More than two-thirds of those who will turn the jab down believe it has not been tested enough. Most also believe the flu has turned out to be so mild, in the vast majority of cases, that the vaccine is not needed. Last night, government experts criticised GPs who decide not to have the jab. Now, this was published on the 25th of August, so this is a brand new story from today. Last night, the government criticised GPs who decide not to have the jab, saying they will put vulnerable patients needlessly at risk. Now, isn't that interesting? I mean, compare that to, you see, we mere, you know, lowly people in the general population, of course, get accused of being nutcases, whack jobs, because we don't believe in vaccination, okay? And, you know, we're constantly being marginalized, right? But here we have, like, half the population, half the doctors in the UK are saying they don't want to have this vaccine. And now the government's turning against them. This should help to put it in perspective for you, okay? Now, this is an amazing story. This is a huge story, but you won't see it, like, on the television. It won't be on the news. It won't be on the BBC, okay? You know, it may eventually, they may have to cover it in some way, but it'll be a very sort of probably tangential kind of story, and they'll probably focus on some, you know, minor aspect, like they have here with the doctors complaining about the multi-dose vials. Well, there's a lot more to it than that. I mean, the doctors here have also said that it's been a very mild flu season, okay? You know, there is no emergency. You know, vaccinating millions of people is a massive thing to do. It's a huge undertaking. And, you know, you only do that sort of thing in a major emergency or a crisis, you know, which we don't have. Okay. So, we have half of the GPs saying that they don't want to have the vaccine. We have also a story from last week, one-third of the nurses don't want the swine flu vaccine. Right. But we have the government announcing that it's going to charge right ahead. And here is a press release. Just getting that up now on my screen. This is a story from Friday of last week. And it says here, Australia's plan to tackle swine flu with vaccinations will go ahead, even though the epidemic may be easing, Prime Minister Kevin Rudd says. See, we're getting it from the Prime Minister. The big man, the man at the top, has said, we're going to get jabbed, okay? And we've got here, this is a story from 9msn.com.au, and we've got a nice little picture here of a lady getting the needle stuck in her arm. And he says a number of doctors told him that surgeons were going for days without any scheduled elective surgeries because hospital beds were not available for their patients. Well, hang on. I mean, look, have a look at the Google flu trends, right? Flu is down in the low level now, okay? So what are we talking about here? That sounds like that's related to some other story. Maybe there's a shortage of hospital beds. It's completely inappropriate in this story. A number of doctors told him that surgeons were going for days without any scheduled elective surgeries because hospital beds were not available for their patients. I mean, look, we'll put this story up. I'd like listeners to read that and understand the complete psyop involved, and I don't think that's an excessive word to use. It's a psychological operation. It's a propaganda operation to use that statement in the context of this story, knowing that we're in an extremely mild flu season. Okay? So if there's a shortage of hospital beds, there's some other reason for it. Okay? Maybe people have got some other diseases. Okay? It's not flu. Okay. Now, after the question and answer session, it says here, Mr. Rudd was asked about the view of some doctors that the swine flu outbreak might be diminishing and the vaccination program might not be necessary. Mr. Rudd, the big man, said, the government relied on the advice of the chief medical officer, Jim Bishop, in the decision to go ahead with the vaccinations. The chief medical officer. I'm not in the business of indicating what should or should not be done in terms of the provision and the deployment of vaccines for swine flu, he said. Well, you know, the story is, you know, headline, H1N1 vaccines plan will go ahead, PM. Okay, the story is, PM says, you're all going to get the jab. Okay, so despite what it says here in, you know, paragraph 5, that's the story. So again, you know, this is just a short story, okay? This is just an example of what's being done on a huge scale. You know, and it's easier to analyze this, right? We've got the text, we can actually break it down. In any television coverage, you're going to find this is much more in-depth and harder to disentangle because it's all done with music and voiceovers and changing of camera shots and all different techniques that they use to confuse you, okay? There's something funny going on here, okay? And there are people all over this country who just aren't going to stand for it. They're not going to accept it. And it's not even just a question of whether we ourselves are going to get vaccinated anymore. And it's not even a question of whether we're going to resist some sort of compulsory vaccination. What they've done already by ramming this through, by railroading us with these misleading news statements, ordering 21 million vaccines at taxpayers' expense, trialing the vaccines on children. I mean, that's bad enough. They've already committed crimes in what they've done. So we don't want to be on the back foot here saying, you know, oh, look, you know, we've got to defend ourselves. We've got to, you know, gee, I don't want to take the vaccine. Don't make me take the vaccine. You know, do I have to take the vaccine? Look, that's a defensive position. We need to be in an offensive position. Because there are millions of us, right? And there's this tiny little clique, this tiny little cabal of government officials and their lackeys and their, you know, their sold out sort of minions who are making this happen. So we need to be on the front foot and telling them already that what they've done and what they've said is unconstitutional. We need to point it out. Now, I'm not an expert in constitutional law by any means. But Australia is a signatory of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. There are certain rights and freedoms enshrined in common law. And we are the owners of our destiny. We are the sovereign owners of this nation. We are not owned, okay? We are not livestock. So, if there isn't something in the constitutional law, well, we need to put it in there, okay? Because we know what we're talking about. We can see it. And anyone with marginal cognitive ability can understand this, okay? That there is something deceptive, something exploitative, and something underhanded about the way the swine flu is being reported and the way the government here and all around the world, the way the governments are dealing with it. And we just have to say no. I mean, we have to stand up and say, no, you're not doing this anymore. So today, really, the people are still kind of sleepwalking, you know. And we've got a few hundred or a few thousand listening to this show. You know, a few thousand around the country on a few forums. You know, but we're an unknown voice generally, okay. And the rest of them are sleepwalking into some sort of disaster that I don't know what it is. I don't want to be alarmist about it, okay, because it's pointless. I don't know whether that disaster is related to the swine flu vaccine or whether this might just be a trial for it. It might just be a trial run. It's the problem, or even they might not be planning to do anything adverse. You know, there might not be a problem with the swine flu vaccine. It doesn't matter. The point is, what has been done already is bad enough. So we need to stop it now, because in 10 years' time, there may be a situation where your worst case scenario, your worst nightmare, actually comes true. And we do have to understand here this incremental process that we've been working under. We've seen it. There's been this slow erosion of people's rights and freedoms over, you know, almost a decade now since 2001. Since September 11, 2001. That was like a starter's gun for a very slow race towards tyranny. So, you know, this show is here to provide a, you know, point of reference, to consolidate information. I hope everyone listening can use that and leave a comment if you have anything to add to this, or send me an email. I do get quite a few emails. We don't get many comments, but I do get quite a few emails. That's probably enough for that topic for now, because we've got a couple of other things to cover. So just bear with me.
You're listening to Truth News Radio Australia, going beyond the spin, deception and propaganda of mainstream news. Visit truthnews.com.au and subscribe now.
Okay, back with Truth News, back with Hereward Fenton, and back with the painful realities of life in the 21st century. Look, one of these days we're going to do a show that's a bit more, you know, lighthearted, but sorry, we just don't have room for that yet. The next story I want to cover is the CIA Blackwater assassination story. Because, look, it's another one of these stories that is absolutely massive. It's an absolute shocker. And, you know, it should be headline story everywhere, okay? But it's been on a few mastheads from the United States. It's been on MSNBC. There's a few TV interviews that have been done. But, gee, you know, I haven't heard much about it here. I think it was on the news a couple of times. And I don't think people realize how significant it is. So, look, just to very quickly summarize for you, the CIA and Blackwater, a private security firm which was hired by the Bush administration, CIA and Blackwater were working hand in hand. CIA was outsourcing all kinds of activities like assassinations to Blackwater. And, you know, on a previous show, we covered some of these incredible allegations that were coming forth about Blackwater's practices in Baghdad and in Iraq. You know, the random killings, the fact that the CEO had proudly, you know, announced that he was dedicated to eradicating Muslims from the planet. You know, he's a Christian supremacist. Okay. I believe his name is Eric Prince. Now, I'm going to play for you an interview and a Keith Olbermann report from MSNBC, including an interview with Jeremy Scahill, the investigative journalist who has broken some of these stories. So I'll just kick that off now.
The news came out that CIA Director Leon Panetta rushed to notify Congress after learning of a secret CIA program to kill Al-Qaeda leaders. We all knew there had to be something more to that. Our third story tonight, more. The New York Times reports the CIA actually outsourced parts of the job to Blackwater, the right-wing mercenary firm that viewed its work in Iraq as obliterating the Muslim faith from the earth and used call signs from the Christian Crusades against Muslims. According to the Times, Blackwater's involvement was, quote, a major reason that Panetta became alarmed and called the emergency meeting. Congresswoman Jan Schakowsky now telling The Nation magazine that House Intelligence Committee will now add Blackwater to its ongoing probe of the CIA plan. Why would the CIA outsource a highly sensitive function? From today's Washington Post, the program was initially managed by the CIA's Counterterrorism Center, but its functions were partly transferred to Blackwater when key officials from the center retired from the CIA and went to work for the private contractor. The Post reporting Blackwater got millions to train CIA teams in simulated kidnappings, but the plan was killed because it failed to get off the ground. Blackwater founder, evangelical patron Eric Prince, got his first CIA contract early in 2002 from CIA Executive Director Alvin Krongard, a good buddy of Prince's, according to The Nation. Mr. Krongard wound up joining, surprise, the Blackwater Advisory Board in 2007. CIA counterterrorism chief Kofor Black, who ran the rendition program in which Blackwater has also been implicated, joined Blackwater in 2005. The Times reports that Blackwater's involvement in the program ended years ago under Bush, quote, after senior CIA officials themselves questioned the wisdom of using outsiders in a targeted killing program. With us once again on this story tonight, The Nation magazine contributor Jeremy Scahill, also author of Blackwater, The Rise of the World's Most Powerful Mercenary Army. Thanks for coming in again.
Nice to be with you, Keith.
Explain why even the Bush administration would think it was a bad idea to pay a private company for something so sensitive that even Congress couldn't be told about it.
I don't think it's necessarily the case that the Bush administration thought it was a bad idea. I mean, let's remember here what's at the center, the epicenter of this scandal is the fact that Dick Cheney is alleged to have ordered the CIA to conceal from the Congress, which has over authority, the existence of a secret CIA assassination plan. Blackwater was on from almost day one of the so-called war on terror as part of the war that Bush labeled a crusade. They worked overtly for the administration. We know as of May of 2002, they were boots on the ground in Afghanistan. I'm not so sure that the program has even ended to this day. Blackwater continues to be paid by the United States government for work in both Afghanistan and Iraq. The issue here, Keith, as Representative Jan Schakowsky told me last night, is how far up the chain did the relationship between Eric Prince and the administration go? She said to me that clearly the Bush administration trusted Eric Prince, the mercenary kingpin of Blackwater, more than the elected representatives of the Congress who are supposed to have oversight because they shared these details with him and not the Congress.
Well, they shared more than details, obviously. They basically shared staffs. It was a sequential thing, the way football coaches retire and work in television for a year and then get another job in football. You've got Kofor Black, Buzzy Krongard, this unnamed group of CIA officials retiring, by the way, to go work at right. at Blackwater. Explain the role of that evolving or the revolving door and the relative to the assassination ring, if you will.
Right. So shortly after 9/11, AK Buzzy Krongard, the number three man at the CIA, meets with Eric Prince and they authorize a $5 million black contract, a covert contract for Blackwater to insert inside of Afghanistan in Kabul, as well as in a town called Shkin, which is along the Afghan-Pakistan border where Blackwater and the CIA operated out of a mud fortress that they called the Alamo. Prince went over over, he's himself a former Navy SEAL, went over with that initial Blackwater deployment. And then after a week or so there, according to a CIA operative that we talked to for my book, Prince then went to Kabul to try to win more business for Blackwater. That launched Blackwater, Keith, as a mercenary operation. At the time that Prince and Krongard were crafting this relationship between the CIA and Blackwater, you had Kofor Black running the CIA's counterterrorism center, leading the hunt for bin Laden, talking about the gloves have come off. There was a before 9/11 and after 9/11, and saying that there were no limits on what operatives would be authorized to do in hunting down terrorists. So you have this history of Blackwater from 2002 to the present, where they've worked overtly and covertly for the U.S. government, and then Prince hires Kofor Black, Buzzy Krongard, Robert Richard, former deputy director of the CIA, Enrique Rick Prado, a veteran of the CIA paramilitary division, to run his own private CIA.
Okay, I'm just going to pause it there. Look, that story, that really should have made your toes curl. These people, it sounds like a gangster story. I mean, these people are operating exactly like a criminal gang. They're doing these secret deals. They're swapping, CIA and Blackwater, interchanging staff members. They're embarking on just outrageous, depraved activities. But all with the kind of, this is where it really gets chilling, right? Because the only thing you can compare it to is like Nazi Germany or Stalinist Russia. But unfortunately, those are stories from the past. This is ongoing, okay? These are totally criminal, depraved elements within the highest levels of the government of the United States. And the Blackwater changed its name. It's now called XE. Google it if you wish. They are still a major contractor to the U.S. government. None of these people have been brought to justice. There are inquiries. There are I think indictments against Eric Prince, and there have been deaths of investigators who were trying to bring a case against him, which it is claimed are murders. Okay. So this is ongoing. This is something, and you've got to understand, this is all about these ongoing imperialistic military operations in which Australia is deeply entwined, deeply involved. So we as a country have blood on our hands, but we as citizens of this country are obviously powerless. We feel powerless. It doesn't matter what what political party we vote for. It doesn't seem to make any difference. We had all this rhetoric from the Labor Party about getting out of Iraq, but all they did is they redeployed troops to Afghanistan, and they still have a major commitment in Iraq anyway. They've got lots of personnel there. They've got training personnel there, and of course the Australian military has a lot of their ex-employees now working for private security firms as well. Mercenary armies. There are a lot of Australians working for these private mercenary armies. This is the sad reality, and this is why we have to keep trying to broadcast the facts. We just have to keep at it. It doesn't matter how monotonous it gets. Tell your co-worker what you heard tonight. Call your friends. Let them know that we are involved as a country in criminal activities, which will, in history be looked back on with disgust by future generations. So at least, you can either be like one of the people that tried to fight against the Nazis, or you can be a Nazi. Now, those who tried to fight against the Nazis in Nazi Germany didn't succeed. We know that. but we respect that they tried, okay? But the vast majority just went along, okay? They just went along to get along. And that's what everyone's doing now. Look, they know that what we're doing in Afghanistan is dirty work, dirty stuff, okay? But they go along to get along, okay? Think about what your grandchildren will think. Try to think about it in a bigger picture. And, you know, if you have this information, try and share it. That's all I can say. You know, this is a story which we'll keep covering. It's still growing. It's not anywhere near over. You know, we're just right in the middle of it now. So, stay tuned. Okay, well, as always, time is pressing, and we are going to have to move on with the second half of the show. We have John Bursell coming on shortly to talk about chemtrails. So I'm just going to leave you with a song here by Nick Drake. It's called Voices.
Are you getting fed up with all the disinformation, deception, spin, propaganda, half-truths and downright lies in mainstream news? Looking for something different? Visit Truth News Radio Australia, www.truthnews.com.au, and may the truth set you free.
Okay, welcome back to part two of Truth News Radio for Tuesday, the 25th of August, 2009, which is coincidentally my birthday. Welcome, John Bursell.
Welcome, Hollywood. Happy birthday.
Yeah, look, thanks very much. It's great to be doing a show on my birthday.
35, is it?
Yeah. No, 26, yeah.
26?
Yeah.
Wow, you look a bit old for your age.
Yeah, look, it's all, you know, can't complain. I'm still pretty healthy, you know, like, I haven't actually seen a doctor in years. I don't get sick much. I'm reasonably fit. You know, I walk, I don't drive. I don't need to take any pharmaceutical medicines for any conditions.
You take all your vaccine injections, but don't you?
Well, I was discussing that in the first half of the show. I don't know if you're aware, John, but like the amount of discussion of the vaccine situation is just, it's out of control. I mean, it's just going in crazy on the blogosphere.
Mm.
But also, a story came out today that 50% of GPs from the UK has said that they won't have the vaccine.
Yeah, I think I've told you before that my local practice that I go to, I've been talking to my doctor about vaccines, and the locum that's there, the female locum, won't give vaccines to anyone. She just won't give them to anyone because she's seen adverse reactions and she doesn't want the blood on her hands, I suppose.
Well, that is amazing. And that's all vaccines, or is it just specific ones? Or she's just...
No, all vaccines.
Really? Really? Well, my goodness. I mean, but, you know...
So there is it's quite a substantial amount of people out there that question the validity of vaccines and the amount of vaccines. You know?
Including doctors, you know.
Absolutely. Well, they see the side effects. I told you I had a fellow at work that I work with that had the flu vaccine 2 years ago and had a complete nervous collapse. So it's been less popular at work to have the free flu shot.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I can well imagine. I mean, but anyway, you know, the government's ordered 21 million. That's one for everyone. Everyone's got to get the jab. That's the implication. And, you know, it's funny, you know, I talk about this at my work, and most of the people at work now, I'm pretty sure they're not going to get it, you know, because of what I've told them. Most people were pretty unaware of it. I just keep bringing it up, you know. I'm one of those people who just brings up these inappropriate things, you know, but, yeah.
Oh, well, we're going to talk about something a bit inappropriate tonight.
Yeah.
That's for sure.
We are. And look, you know, we run the risk of offending some of our listeners. And, you know, I said earlier in the show that that is certainly not our intention, you know, and if you disagree with a substantive part of what we're going to say in this show, bring it on, you know, bring the facts, and I will always look at facts.
I personally will be using I suppose as a measure of the facts. I always like to compare it to 9/11, you know, which is my favorite subject, and it's the, you know, it's a conspiracy, I suppose, theory, as they like to call it, that actually has a lot of hard evidence around it, and similar to, you know, something like JFK. The chemtrails pretty light on evidence and pretty heavy on paranoia. That's the way I'm seeing it.
I totally agree.
Talk about it, and maybe we'll discover a point of view. I don't really have a point of view just yet, but I'm working on it.
Sure. Well, look, I've already done an intro to this topic at the beginning of the show for our listeners. So I think what we're ready for now is for you to, from your position as a Boeing engineer, someone who, you know, you probably know as much as anyone about how those jet planes function, how the fuel systems work, how the engines work. I mean, you'd know basically what would be required for them to to modify.
Well, I think we'll just, how about if we just do a quick overview of the chemtrail conspiracy theory as it stands?
I'm happy to do that.
And just talk about, I'll just maybe lead you through a brief overview. I've just been looking into the last few days.
Sure, yeah.
Basically, the chemtrail conspiracy theory began around 1996. There was a paper that came out, I believe it was called Weather as a Force Multiplier, basically a way that the military was looking at controlling weather in certain tactical situations to give them an advantage over their enemy. Okay, so that was that came out through the Air Force's university, and that sort of raised concerns that they were going to practice, you know, weather modification. Now, I have no doubt that they have tried to modify weather.
Okay,
Modify weather. I also have no doubt that in the 50s and 60s they did spray populations. We know they sprayed the men in Vietnam as well with certain things. Obviously, the foliants like Agent Orange were used as well. But, you know, there's been a history of the American military paying little attention to its civilian population and using them as guinea pigs. So, yeah, I think that, you know, so we know what the basis of the conspiracy theory is based around the idea of the military experimenting on populations, weather modification. Also, now in recent times, we've got this eugenics theme that keeps coming into new conspiracy theories that we see popping up all around the place. You know, whether it's vaccinations or it's you know, chemtrails or other things. So, you know, there's a lot of stuff in there that's got some, you know, basis in fact and in historical precedent. So, you know, I don't question anyone for, you know, being concerned about, you know, the possibility they might be getting sprayed by chemtrails. Whether it's a reality is something that I'll question. And I think it's in the context of 9/11, especially, that people really don't have any trust for the bloody government anymore. And, you know, and consequently, I think people are paranoid. And, you know, they're probably justified in being paranoid. But we just have to be careful that we keep looking for the evidence, because there's no point running around, you know, worrying about contrails, which are condensation trails from aircraft, being chemtrails, when, you know, they're just a normal phenomenon that we see regularly that's quite easy to explain. So, you know, there are other things that we might have that come onto us from the air. You know, there are things like chaff that they use as a radar, a radar shield. They throw out these, because I've heard people talk about things they've seen in the air, and I think maybe there is some evidence of this, where we have a glass fiber that's metallized, that's used as a radar prevention from picking up other aircraft, like as a mask, as a shield. They do that. They do drop those canisters out. We have aircraft that jettison fuel when they've got to do a landing in an emergency situation, so we do get fuel sprayed out of aircraft occasionally. There are some other things, obviously, that in America they have 4 aircraft on the register, and officially on the register in the American Air Force there, that are still used today for spraying. But generally, that's you know, for mosquitoes, etc., in different areas. They've got a couple of Hercules or 4 Hercules that are specifically designed for spraying you know, it could be defoliants, it could be for mosquitoes, it could be for other uses. But
can I just interject one thing there?
There's no aircraft on the Australian register by the Air Force that I'm aware of, definitely, that's not listed in our ORBAT, but particularly for spraying of people.
Can I just interject one thing there, John? I just wanted to interject one thing, is that to point out that there's one difference between all of those examples you've cited and so-called chemtrails, is that so-called chemtrails occur at like 30,000 feet cruising altitude, whereas everything you're talking about is at a much lower altitude.
That's correct. Well, that's where the evidence lies for spraying, is that low altitude.
Yeah, yeah. Please continue. Yeah, thanks.
Yeah, yeah. So I'm coming to that. Yeah. So anyway, really, realistically, we don't have any precedent or any photos or any facts. I know there was a photo or a series of photos of getting around the internet that showed some tanks on a commercial aircraft. I think myself might have been one of the first ones to debunk that, which was it was used as a test bed and it was used as ballast. They were pumping liquids around the aircraft to weight it in different ways to change the center of gravity for testing.
What is a test bed? What does that actually mean?
A test bed?
Yeah, what is a test bed?
Well, testbed, like if they've got a new aircraft type or if they're changing an aircraft, they're modifying it for certain, it might be as an aircraft fueler or it might be as a cargo aircraft. They might be changing a design of an aircraft or modifying it. They'll use a particular aircraft as a testbed. So it's an aircraft that's purely to be used for testing, for future modification of that type of aircraft. So that's just a term they use for that aircraft, a test bed. We've seen photos of tanks on board an aircraft, which was a test bed, where they were pumping fluids around to change the center of gravity in the aircraft, because obviously the center of gravity in the aircraft is crucial to its ability to fly and how controllable it is. So, they're the sort of things that we know about. So I'm not saying that people that think we could be sprayed from time to time as part of military experimentation, or we could be sprayed from time to time for, reasons of mosquitoes, etc., at the whim of the government because they think it's a good thing to do. That's happened, and it could happen again. But these high altitude, above sort of 26, 27, 28,000 feet, low temperature, thin air, moist air, it's normally in very moist air, over 60, 70% humidity, that we find we get condensation trails, okay, which are called contrails. Now, we see them over Sydney on certain times of the year, certain still days where we have a humid, higher levels of the atmosphere. An aircraft takes off, it gets to a high altitude, and what happens is as the gas turbine engine is burning the fuel, it compresses air, okay? It's actually a huge compressor. So just the same way that your air conditioner has a compressor and it makes water, you'll see it dripping water, from its water extracting system, because you have to take that water out of the air or you'd have mold right throughout your house when you're cooling it down. It produces water. So when you compress air, you take a whole lot of air and you make it smaller, you have more water and it tends to condense and form droplets. And so we get water. So in the situation with the gas turbine engine, we've got a jet stream coming out of the back. Most of the engine, most of the air that comes through that engine is just bypassed. It doesn't go through the compressor. It's really just a big propeller that's dragging the air through the engine that propels the aircraft. But the compressor section or the engine section is what drives that propeller. And the little bit of exhaust that comes out of that, which is the narrow pipe at the back of the engine, that has aerosols in it. It has soot particles, and it has water droplets and obviously CO2 and other products of combustion. But it is that air that when it goes into a very cold environment, it condenses, and about a wingspan back from the aircraft, you get a condensation trail forming if it's the right conditions. Like obviously, different conditions, different thrust settings, different altitudes, different types of days, different wind. All these things vary how that contrail is going to look. Wing vortices, all sorts of things can vary the way it looks. So it's really quite variable, and they can last from, a few minutes, nearly instantaneously disappearing, which we hear the people that push the chemtrail argument say, oh, look, they should disappear instantly. Well, sometimes. But other times they actually form clouds, and they encourage through these particles that come out of the engine and the water moisture that's there, it actually starts a cloud off. So you can have a cirrus, I think that's the correct term of type of cloud it is, cloud form from the contrail, and it can actually spread and grow.
Hey, John, so, are you familiar with chaos theory at all?
Well, I am a little bit. Yeah, it's just basically the theory that anything can happen if the right situation's there.
Yeah,
is that what you're talking about?
I tried to explain this earlier in a way, and I referred to chaos theory because with complex dynamic systems, like anything to do with weather, anything to do with thermodynamics, the only mathematical way of modeling that's ever been able to get anywhere near, to explain the way dynamic systems work is chaos theory. And the thing about chaos theory, and I'll let you continue in a second, but I just want to remind the audience of this, is that with chaos theory, one tiny change in one input can completely change the way a system behaves. The classic example is the butterfly flapping its wings starts a hurricane, okay? Now, the reason why they use that as an example is it's just a simplified example. But very small inputs change the way dynamic systems work and can push them in different directions. And you have to have you can't actually predict it. This is the thing. You can't predict it, and it will not, the tiniest difference will produce a massively different outcome. And you just apply it to anything that's a real world example of, imagine you're playing pool and you hit the ball and you feel like you've hit the ball exactly in the middle, but instead of knocking the ball into the hole, it just doesn't go into the hole, and you did it exactly right, because the tiniest difference in your impact angle caused a slightly different, friction and movements, and then the ball didn't go in the hole.
I think that makes good sense in, say, for instance, if we use the example with chemtrails, which is the subject.
Yeah.
But if we're rising in altitude, we're maybe rising in altitude at, 1,000 feet per minute.
Yeah.
Say for instance, and we have a particular day where, the saturation point of the moisture coming out of that engine, and this is how it works. It's like when a liquid goes to a gas, or a gas goes to a liquid, or a liquid goes to a solid, it happens instantly, doesn't it? It hits a certain point and it happens. So if you're climbing out with an aircraft, you could hit a certain point where all of a sudden you've got a contrail where you didn't have a contrail before. Now, this is where we've had this switch argument where people are saying, well, how can it be there and then not be there? Or how can it go on and off? Well, it can, depending on the situation. Like the atmosphere, like we know with turbulence, say for instance, that we can be flying along in clean air that looks completely clean, and we can hit an area of lower pressure, and the aircraft can drop 1,000 feet just like that.
Exactly.
Because of certain wind and certain currents and certain this and certain that, varying factors that cause, like you're sort of saying with that chaos theory, that strange things happen, and they do, and often reality is stranger than fiction. So, I think that, most of these situations, the people that have talked about chemtrails with me have explained situations. I think they're explainable, and it's all reasonable. There's reasonable explanations for what's going on if you understand the science. Now, I remember Chris was mentioning, who you've had on the show.
Yeah,
he was
Chris
saying
Tolan,
that he saw these fibers this day that he could see coming down in the sunlight, and he grabbed them. Now, I don't really know what that could be, but say, for instance, it could be this chaff stuff that they drop out of aircraft as shielding. They could have been doing exercise and fired some of these chaff canisters out of the back of a military plane. It's not hard to do. A lot of them are fitted with these. It's basically a system of firing out these little canisters that put this polymer or glass, that's encoded with some sort of metallic residue that causes this radar anomaly. That could have been what it was, or it could have been something someone threw out of a high-rise building somewhere. Who knows?
Yeah, I have trouble understanding how anyone could prove that a plane 10 kilometres above you produced something that you saw, at ground level. I can't see how you can make that conclusion.
Unless there's the things start to happen that make people really get interested in investigating further. I always use 9/11 as an example. Now we've seen this year we've seen a team of scientists, of nine scientists, a couple of PhDs, a couple of universities get directly involved in investigating the dust from the World Trade Center, and they've done some really good research. It's been peer reviewed, published, and it's hard evidence. And it exists. And a lot of scientists, you'll talk to scientists, nothing in their world exists until it's peer-reviewed and published. Basically, it doesn't mean anything until it gets to that level.
Yeah.
So, I challenged the chemtrail people. There was a chemtrail speaker at the Inverell Forum who I didn't get to see because I had to head home on the train. I couldn't stay for his lecture. It didn't necessarily look great from a mainstream point of view.
Right.
He looked pretty much like someone that lived out in the bush somewhere.
Wasn't that well presented,
A few earrings and this, that, and the other. Not make any judgment, but he wasn't a scientist, but he was someone that had a website that was writing to chemtrails, and I was going to be quite interested in asking him a few pointed questions, but I didn't get a chance. But I know there's a lot of, people out there that are quite convinced that they're real, but I just haven't seen any concerted effort by any group. But there have been groups in the States that have refuted and done studies and found that, that these chemtrail arguments are completely unfounded. But on the other hand, there's that InfoWars story where they had that report from that local TV station that this fellow said that he saw some planes flying overhead and then he caught something in the air and he's got it in a jar full of water. I'm not sure why it's full of water. And it had a high level of barium. Now, you know, and the bearing was destined, it was at a high level, but we've got absolutely no chain of custody.
You've got no way of knowing exactly how that barium got in that jar, have you?
Well, how do we know? Yeah. You know, we absolutely, yeah. It's not courtable evidence. So, yeah. You know, unless you can get a chain of custody of something and actually find out where it's coming from. And believe me, if, you know, if they were spraying, well, let's stop there for a second. Let's think about if they were spraying. Say, for instance, they were putting something in the kerosene, the jet fuel that they put in jet aircraft. Say they were doing that, okay? I'll go through a couple of scenarios. Let's start with the engineering point of view. Now, these aircraft are injected engines, and they use high-pressure injection pumps, and, you know, they're highly controlled engines. Everyone in the airline industry wants to see the engine perform at absolute peak performance, because the biggest number one cost in aviation is the fuel. It's about 25, in some cases up to 50% of the cost of running an airline is the fuel. Okay, so no one wants to waste any. They want to make sure the engines are running absolutely as efficiently as they can, and they don't want any additives in there or any toxic things or heavy metals or anything that might cause fouling of that system or reduce engine life. And I'm telling you, if there was anything...
Sorry about that, John. I was just lining up a video there.
If there was anything that was in the fuel that which wasn't supposed to be there, it would be making an impact on those engines. It would be gunking up, it would be building up, there'd be residues. The EPA tests, you know, we do tests on engine exhaust because we have a problem with carcinogens being in the synthetic oil that gets burnt. These things are being tested and looked at quite regularly. And, you know, the engines are being examined under the microscope because they want to get the absolute best you know, efficiency out of these engines they can, and if they sense that there's anything wrong with the fuel, they're going to be straight to Shell and Caltex and all the rest of them and getting up them for the rent if it's cost them anything in engine performance, I'll tell you. So that's really, to me, it's unrealistically putting anything in the kerosene. But just say if they were. Now, you know, the Murdochs and the Kissingers and all these other people in the world, you know, all the players in the Bilderberg groups and the CFR and all these other groups that we know control the political agenda in the geopolitical world, they're all out there breathing this air just the same as us. I don't see them cancelling trips anywhere. And, I certain days of the year or, you know, it just, for me, it seems completely ridiculous that we'd be spraying something from so high in the air to poison us. Because everyone would be getting some of it. Because sometimes we had jet streams up at those high levels of the atmosphere where aircraft cruise, which is between basically 30,000 and 42,000 feet, which is where the contrails are produced predominantly. You know, there's jet streams up there that can be blowing, you know, a couple hundred kilometres an hour. Now, things that you drop up there can spread over a very, very large area, and you wouldn't be able to control who was getting the poison and who wasn't if they were spraying it. That's why when they spray crops or they spray people or whatever they're doing actually to do these things, they do it at a very, very low level, so they control where the spray's going. The spray's also normally very heavy, so it drops very fast because they want to get it onto the ground and get it onto the target. They don't want to be spreading it up there in the air. Now, if they were spraying up there for weather modification and they were putting sulfur dioxide or whatever it might be to reflect sun and all the rest of it, which I believe they have done trials on, yeah, then they're spraying it way up there. But they're using specialised aircraft.
Absolutely.
To do that, right?
Yeah.
We don't even have any in Australia, as far as I'm aware. So,
okay, that's good.
You know, I know there's people in Australia that think they've been poisoned by chemtrails. I know there's people that are convinced they've been poisoned by chemtrails.
Absolutely.
In
look,
Australia.
And there has
and
been.
I'd be worried about that.
I mean, it's fair to say there has been some mainstream news coverage. I'm just going to play a short clip here from one of the news stories that was broadcast in the US, and you can just comment on it if you like. Just a short clip here. I'll just play that just for our listeners to, you know, broaden out this story so they can get a perspective on it from the mainstream media. Hang on. Sorry, I'm just going to rewind that again. That's all right. Here we go.
Could a strange substance found by a Southwest Arkansas man be part of a government test? Well, that's the question at the heart of a phenomenon called chemtrails, now getting widespread attention. Well, tonight, KSLA News 12 investigation reporter Jeff Farrell shows us the results of testing we had done about what's in our skies.
It seemed like some mornings it was just crisscrossing the whole sky. They were just, it was just like a giant checkerboard.
Bill Nichols snapped several photos of the strange clouds from his home in Stamps, Arkansas. They begin as normal contrails from a jet engine, but do not fade away like a normal contrail. Soon after, he saw particles in the air.
You know, because we'd see it drop to the ground in a haze.
I just want to pause it there, just to comment on that statement, right? Now, see, people think, oh, I saw it on television. Wow, it must be real. Well, okay, everything on television is entertainment, okay? Now, occasionally, the mainstream picks up on conspiracy theories. It does happen, okay?
Well, they're very popular, aren't they?
Yeah, and you know, the whole point of these television shows is they're constantly looking for some titillation. And it doesn't mean anything to me, the fact that it's been on mainstream television. It doesn't prove anything in terms of whether it's credible or not. It's just interesting, you know. But the point that guy just made there was that he saw the plane go over and then he saw particles. Again, I can't see how you can make a connection. I can't see empirically, scientifically, how you can say any particle that you came from a plane that
was
30,000 feet.
He said there, Harold, he said that there was chemtrails crisscrossing the sky in this intense grid. Is that what he said?
Well,
he
did say crisscrossing, yeah.
Okay, well, I hear this intense grid and crisscrossing like they're spraying, you know, they make that. Now, I don't know, I'll just give some people some background the way aircraft operate. Now, an aircraft, its navigation systems are reasonably accurate, you know. We do use GPS these days, but not as a primary navigation in most aircraft. It depends on the situation. But aircraft are reasonably accurate, you know, so they will tend to follow a very similar path if they're flying from a certain wave point to another certain wave point. And most routes that aircraft fly are flown by other aircraft on the same day. Like, they tend to fly to certain points. You know, whether they're navigation stations or whether they're wave points, which is just the point in space. If you're in the airline industry, it's the same everywhere, right? So the FMC, the flight management computers, are uploaded with the current data, which is the certain flight paths that the company routes. Now, they're agreed to by the Civil Aviation Authority, and they're, you know, the most expedient, and they're designed for certain reasons to not go over certain populations, depending on where it is, all these reasons. But anyway, they tend to follow the same routes, and they tend to fly, you know, aircraft are generally flying in north, south, east, west type routes in America and Australia, you know, predominantly. So to see a group of contrails on a certain day, you know, in that certain elevation band, in that certain zone where there's enough water, moisture, and it's cold enough, to see them crisscrossing the sky makes complete sense to me.
Yeah,
complete sense.
Because they follow a regular pattern, yeah. So
yeah,
they're all different flight paths.
The slight difference is because the navigation accuracy is slightly different, and often they'll have them at slightly apart, you know. You know, they might fly a little bit to the left or the right the route, you know, within that aero range, but it tends to be within, you know, say a sort of over a kilometre or so.
Okay.
And that's not unusual. It's quite normal.
Excellent. Okay. I'll just continue with this story.
Nichols then noticed the material collecting on the ground.
This is water and stuff that I collected in bowls. I had it set out in my backyard on my dad's pickup
truck.
Holding
up a jar here.
KSLA News 12 had the sample tested at a lab. The results? A high level of barium, 6.8 parts per million. More than three times the toxic level set by the EPA. Armed with these lab results about the high levels of barium found in our sample, we decided to contact the Louisiana Department of Environmental Quality. They told us that yes, these levels are very unusual, but at the same time, they added the caveat that proving the source is a whole nother matter. Barium is a hallmark of other chemtrail testing, which even attracted attention from a Los Angeles TV station. There's already no shortage of unclassified weather modification programs by the government. But those who fear chemtrails could be secret biological or chemical testing on the public point to the 1977 Senate hearings in particular, which confirmed 239 populated areas had been contaminated with biological agents between 1949 and 1969. Later, the 1994 Rockefeller Report concluded hundreds of thousands of military personnel were also subjected to secret biological experiments over the last 60 years. But could secret testing be underway yet again?
I'd rather it be something inert and benign, you know, something that's, you know, not causing any damage, but I'd like to know what it is.
KSLA News 12 discovered chemtrails are even mentioned by name in the initial draft of House Bill 2977 back in 2001 under the Space Preservation Act. But the military denies any such program exists. Jeff Farrell, KSLA News 12 reporting.
Okay, now they referred there to the House bill written by Dennis Kucinich.
Yep.
Have you had a chance to look into that at all?
Well, I know that he withdrew the chemtrails in the second draft.
Yeah.
But, like, I think, you know, I think it, considering what that bill was, which was, you know, really, you know, trying to prevent these sorts of things happening, you know, it's definitely possible that
but
they
I
know,
tell you what
tried, with the modification, you know, it doesn't mean that they're existing right now. It doesn't mean that every aircraft that flies overhead that produces a contrail is a chemtrail. What it means is Kucinich, being a smart man, wise man, and a man that understands history, knows that they've done these sorts of things before, and he's trying to introduce a bill that prevents them from doing it, making it illegal.
And what I find difficult about that, though, is that with the word itself, you see, the word is not really a word in the English language that I don't think.
Well, it's not
like,
recognised as anything. Yeah, that's
so,
correct.
So why did he use that specific word? Because that's 2001. That's a long time ago. Most of these websites that talk about chemtrails have popped up since then. What was he referring to? Was there already a body of knowledge? Was there already...
Well, 1996 was when the chemtrail, because of that, that weather modification for military purposes, university... piece that was written that I mentioned earlier, that
right.
was when
okay.
the chemtrail conspiracy theory kicked off. Well, that's sort of what seems to be what most people say. So, yeah, so it was around a long time before 9/11 and all the other things that have happened.
Right.
That's for sure. There was definitely people thinking that that had been done. You know, it's sort of similar to, I suppose, things like, you know, mind control and other... you know, secret things, you know, Area 51 and all these other things that have been around a long, long time. The concept of them spraying us has been around, you know. Obviously, they were doing it in the 50s and 60s. So, yeah, I think the ideas have been out there. So when the actual word chemtrail came into in being, I'm not sure, but officially it was around 1996.
Sometime
so
around,
I don't know whether they used chemtrails in this document that they wrote from the Air Force University.
Okay.
But I think it's the name originated from condensation trails, which got shortened to contrails, to chemical trails that got shortened to chemtrails. So I think that's where the word came from. But it doesn't actually exist. You're correct. It doesn't actually exist as a recognized phenomena.
Yeah.
Phenomenon.
Yeah. Okay, that's really good. Look, we've addressed the issue of the crisscrossing, which is often brought up as a, you know, one of the arguments that, oh, well, is crisscrossing, therefore it must be something. Well, I think we've addressed that. There's another one I want to address because it came to me in an email from one of the listeners to this show, and I think I forwarded some of that email to you. And one of the links there actually shows two planes, one of them producing a persistent contrail, the other one not. And they look like they're at the same altitude, but it's a bit hard to tell, isn't it? I mean, they're both just tiny dots up in the sky. But I just wonder if you could speak to that at all, because that some people seem to find that extremely convincing.
Sorry, could you just say that again?
Yeah,
I just
sure.
missed some of it.
Yeah, that's fine. There's an email I received from one of the listeners to Truth News, which actually has some links in it. One of them is to a video that shows two planes. One plane is producing a chemtrail, the other is not, but they're both up very high up and they look roughly at the same altitude.
Okay.
And this is an argument which has been put to me as
very
convincing.
I know where you're coming from now. Okay, well, I say for instance, I was mentioning it earlier, I know that the military and other scientists have done tests where they've actually had different aircraft. Case in point was a 707 and... I think it was an Airbus 340 or something, two four-engine aircraft. One was producing contrails, and the other wasn't at the same altitude.
Okay.
Exactly the same altitude.
Okay. Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because the types of engines. This is the way I would immediately think of this. The JT8 engine, which is a about a 70% pure jet and about a 30% bypass, which means that the jet section of the engine, which I was talking about the compressor before, where the fuel gets burnt, it produces a lot of the thrust. And that's how old engines were. The original jet engines didn't have any real bypass at all. They were just like you put the fuel in and it made an explosion, and that's where your power came from. As jet engines have advanced, they've become more and more bypass. Now they're up to about 85% bypass, which means there's a massive propeller at the front of the engine that's doing most of the work, and the actual jet section of the engine's driving that fan, so it's working to drive the fan, but the jet blast is coming out from the combustion area there of the engine through the turbine is only a very small part of the thrust. Okay, so the JT8 engine, in the case of the 707, is mostly a thrust engine and a low bypass, where the bypass fan engine on the Airbus 340 is like an 80% bypass engine, a very low jet. So consequently, it'd be a lot. You know, it was the one that was producing the contrail, and the jet engine wasn't. Now, so I'm not sure why that is, but there's a big difference in the way it's producing its power, and there's a big difference in the exhaust from those two engines. Can you see the difference?
Yeah, totally, and you've explained
it. So once again, we're talking about one
clear
major factor changing considerably.
Yeah.
We're going to see different things. But also, I'd challenge anyone to be able to pick 3,000 or 4,000 or 5,000 feet difference between two aircraft.
Yeah,
from the ground level, it's not very easy to do. Obviously, if you knew what type of aircraft they were, the difference in size might be quite easy to see. But it's really something that it's all guesswork, isn't it?
Well,
it's all guesswork.
I mean, there's obviously a critical threshold of temperature and humidity that allows
and pressure that related to and the particles, because you've got to remember this water droplets that form in the condensation trail that become ice. What allows it to break over from what allows the saturation of the air to occur and for the water droplets to break into ice is these particles that are being produced from the engine as well.
Absolutely, yeah.
So there's like all these factors. There's not just two factors, there's probably five or six factors.
Well, yeah, I mean, I've read a bit of the theory about how clouds form, and it's generally believed that clouds do form around some sort of particle. So
That's what cloud seeding is about too, is to get them to change into rain, isn't it? That's part of the process there as well.
Yeah, and it is possible to seed clouds, although the techniques that are used are actually about seeding clouds to make them rain rather than creating clouds. Look, It's quite possibly feasible to create clouds too, and I'm not going to say that I know that's not happening, but what I just wanted to point out was that with these clouds that form, you'll see them forming in the same conditions that cirrus clouds form normally, and you can watch cirrus clouds form out of nothing. Have you ever just looked up and watched the sky for a while?
Well, they can form from dust storms.
Like, it's amazing. Like, you can watch clouds just forming out of nothing, and they'll disappear again, too. I mean, clouds are really amazing to watch.
It might be Wonder Woman's plane.
It's
invisible.
The whole point is that clouds are fascinating phenomenon. I really think you've got to look into the chaos theory aspect to appreciate how complex and mysterious it is. So it's not at all surprising that you're going to get a plane, 1 minute's producing a chemtrail, the next minute it's not. I won't call them chemtrails, I'll just call them persistent contrails, just so that we get our terminology clear. The same plane...
So there's three types of contrails, isn't there? Condensation trails. The persistent type, which is, there's the ones that expand.
Right.
And there's the disappearing type.
Yeah.
They're three. They're well known. It's well known, well studied, well understood principles of why those three type form. Ones that disappear immediately, the ones that linger but stay in a straight line, and the ones that spread. It all depends on the conditions. And they've all been studied. And you can read about them. You can find out about these. I found the articles at Wikipedia quite enlightening about these subjects, and I think everyone, like even with 9/11 and with JFK and other things, you read the Wikipedia site or some of these mainline sites, there's still a lot of good information there, and yeah. They don't normally directly lie. Yeah, they tend to taint things in a certain way because of the people that are editing them.
Absolutely.
But you still can get a good broad view of the subject through those sources.
You can still get
and
a lot
of
information.
People should always read those sort of sources first, and then go looking, you know, for hard evidence and for the deeper conspiracy if it is there, you know.
Absolutely. And look, I tell you, the thing that changed my mind on it finally, because I've spent a lot of time looking at this, and I've been swayed in different directions. You know, it's a bit like the Pentagon issue, which we discussed last week. You know, I've gone from one site to the next, thinking, you know, the last thing I read is what I think. You know, and I've been very confused by some of these chemtrail stories, but when it finally tipped me over the line was when I saw all of these amazing photographs that were taken during World War II. And what they show, I don't know if you've seen these, John, but they're, and we'll post them on the site, on the Truth News notes, they show fighter bombers and Spitfires and a whole lot of different planes producing classic chemtrails, okay?
From a jet engine, simply from the exhaust from their motors and the particles in certain conditions were causing these contrails.
And there's a really good explanation for why those particular planes were producing these trails. Is they were flying very unusual flight patterns. They were going way up high to, like, you know, 15,000, 20,000 feet, and then diving down again. Like that, they were doing all kinds of aerial maneuvers to get away from, you know, the planes that were chasing them, etc. I don't know if they went as high as 20,000. They definitely went up to at least 10,000.
Well, I don't think they had oxygen in World War.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure. They might have. They might have had oxygen for certain operations.
They could have.
Normally you can only go up to 15,000 feet is really your maximum ceiling.
Yeah, I think
before
it's probably
you start to suffer hypoxia.
Right. Something like that. And what you can see with these photos is that the planes, and there's some actual video as well, which was filmed.
I've seen some photos, but yeah, I should probably check that out. It'd be interesting.
Yeah, because what you can see is the planes are, sometimes they're producing the contrails, sometimes they're not. And again, that's totally to be expected because they're going through different altitudes where the temperature and humidity are different. And, you know, sometimes it's there, sometimes it isn't. Now, the chemtrail conspiracy theorist comes along and says, oh, someone's switching it on and switching it off like it's a, you know, like it's a pump, you know. Well, you know, obviously you wouldn't, we don't seriously think that they were doing that in World War II, do we? I mean, I think they were a bit too busy trying to, like, fight the war and not get shot down. I don't think that in World War II they were spraying chemtrails, okay? So what you're seeing there is a phenomenon that is perfectly explained by physics and, you know, temperature, humidity, etc., all those complex factors. It's a fascinating topic. You know, and I think we're totally justified in investigating it, totally justified in being concerned, and it's understandable that people get paranoid as well. I get paranoid. We all do, and it's understandable because there's a lot of threats, and you tend to jump at shadows when you're surrounded by a threatening world, such as we're living in the post 9/11 reality that we've all, you know, woken up to. Many of us have.
Yeah, and it's good that, you know, when you can have, I've never worried about them because, you know, I've dismissed them right from the beginning. But, you know, like I took some time that when people send me links, I have a look into it and I've, you know, continually not been convinced. And, you know, I thought it was interesting when I've got a bit of flack over the fact that we talked about the moon landing as well a few weeks back.
Absolutely.
I think, you know, it is good to look at these things and, you know, in the moon landing situation, there was some interesting things have popped up, some things I can't explain. I'm still, you know, a believer that we went to the moon. But, you know, it was quite valid to have a look because obviously these conspiracy theories or these ideas don't come to fruition from nothing. In the chemtrail situation, we have historical precedences where they've done these sorts of things. We have events like 9/11 that prove to us that, you know, that our governments will conspire to kill their own people for their own gain. Historically, we know that's true. So, I mean, the situation for chemtrails to rise as an idea, there's definitely some validity there, and that's how come it's become a bit of a phenomenon, you know, and there's a lot of people that are interested in it. And I think you asking me to have a look into this and us to have a conversation about it tonight is valid. And, you know, if it puts some people's minds at ease, then I think that's good, because there's certain fights that we really need to be fighting at the moment. You know, we're just coming to the end of the dead cat bounce with the financial situation. We're probably looking at some very bad times coming in the next few years. You know, that's something we really should be worrying about and looking into. If anyone's got any superannuation, I just put mine to cash. But anyway, that's excellent. Just what I did. I'm not an economist, but
that's interesting.
I think it's
okay.
A good time to be a little bit safe if you've been watching the market. Also, you know, we've got 9/11. We've got this unbelievable amount of evidence now that we just have to try to get to break through into the media. We know that we're winning the argument with our peers, with our friends. You know, just every day it just gets easier and easier to talk about 9/11, and it's really woken a lot of people up. It's also caused some paranoia, which we're seeing demonstrated with some of the things getting a little bit out of control, like chemtrails, and also I believe the eugenics arguments sometimes are a little bit out of control. I think you've probably touched
indeed
on that recently too.
Well, it's hard to know which are the out of control bits. What I see is there's plenty of, you know, solid information which we should be very concerned about. Then I see people wanting to add to that with extremely speculative stuff, and that's what I find a bit disappointing, because there's just a wealth of information we've got, and you know, we really need to stick with that and not sort of continually want to add more and add more. It's like, you know, that doesn't really help.
We've got a situation with, you know, people are worrying about this chemtrails, but the facts are that, you know, fluoride's a poison and it's in the water. And,
yeah,
you know, the concerns
yeah
about that are justified. And that's a real fight that needs to be continually fought on, and it needs to be brought up. You know, so there's lots of real issues out there that then we need to keep focus on. And we need to, if we don't have evidence for things, and, you know, people need to do their research, they need to look into, you know, understanding this subject, and they need to move on. Once they decide, like I did a long time ago about contrails, you know, or chemtrails being called contrails and the hysteria that was coming from that, you know, I'm not wasting any time on that. I'm moving on with things that I can prove, things that I can make a difference with, and things that, you know, are going to make, you know, my children's life on this world an easier life.
Excellent, excellent. And look, we need to wind up in a minute, but just speaking of moving on, what's the plan for September 11 this year? Can you just give our listeners let them know what we're planning here in Sydney. I believe September 11 is going to be...
I put out a call for a media-focused campaign using the Semitic paper and the DVD blueprint for 9/11 Truth. And, at the Sydney group, our plan is to attend the ABC studios at 11 a.m. on September 11.
So that's Friday. That's a Friday, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a Friday, and
okay,
we'll be there all day long. And we'll, you know, I'm taking down some info packs for any journalists that come along, which will contain the Semitic paper and a DVD blueprint for truth, and also the new Semitic material lecture that Dr. Stephen Jones gave recently. I've got the DVD for that now,
okay,
which is great. I've got 10 copies actually, so anyone that turns up at the action there, you can get a copy of that at below cost, just be $10. I've got Humuk sent me out a few hot off the press from 911tv.org. Anyway, so I've got them in the boxes, so I'll have a few down there if anyone wants one of those. And anyway, we're going to get down there and we're just, you know, just sit on the bullhorn all day and call out the ABC for not following their charter, which is to inform the Australian public. And I truly believe that since 9/11, the Australian government's been on a course to disaster, destroying our reputation in the world as a kind and righteous, just country. You know, we've become warmongers like the US, and we continue to fight these wars of aggression on other people's land, you know, which we have to stop. And we need to keep pointing to the fact that we've proven that 9/11 was an inside job. We've proven the towers were brought down by a method of controlled demolition, and we have the evidence, and we just need someone to report it. And I really think we need to try to get someone in the ABC to report on Semitic paper. We know that I'm just trying to think, Robin Williams, the science editor of the ABC, has received a copy of this paper, We know that many other people, I'm sure, have received links to the paper through emails. And so the plan is, everyone that that's listening, if you could, in the days preceding 9/11, you could send an email to the ABC asking why they haven't reported on why they haven't reported on the thermitic material that has been found, the unused nanothermite that's been found in the dust of the World Trade Center that's been published in a peer-reviewed journal, the Bentham Press. And if they, you know, it's easy to find a link to that paper. Find a link, send an email to the ABC, ring the ABC, write to the ABC, ask them why they haven't reported on that news, why our tax funds aren't getting the service that they're supposed to provide, and come down to the ABC studios and help us protest. And as we know from the protests we did down there before, Harold, you managed to get an article up in the blog there, in the Unleashed blog. And
Absolutely.
We also got the BBC special on Building 7, which hadn't been previously seen in Australia at all, to my knowledge. Before that time, we actually got an hour, on the ABC Four Corners, where they showed, the story of Building 7. It might have been biased, might have been propaganda, but at least the Australian people got to see Building 7. We know we've had success there before. There are good people at the ABC. We just need to get down there and call them out for their continuing war crimes.
Okay, that was an excellent roundup. And just to clarify, the protests will begin at the ABC instead of Town Hall. It's going to begin at the ABC studios.
Ultimate,
is that right?
Studios, which is very easy to find. It's not too far from Central Station. Just look it up. The ABC Ultimo Studios. I'm sure Harold will be sending out an email. You'll find the information at 9/11 Oz. You can also find the article that I wrote there about calling for a media-focused campaign on 9/11. It's also up 9/11 blogger.
Excellent.
Okay,
great. Look, I think that about wraps it up for tonight. I think
we'll go out to Josh's dad. I hope he gets well soon.
Yeah. We hope to hear from Josh while he's in Germany. I'm hoping to get a report from him on September 11. Thanks a lot for coming on, John. And as always, it's been great talking. And keep up the fight.
No worries. Thanks, Herod.
Okay, thanks. Cheers. Good night. Bye.